Thanks for that. Welcome to Newsday. We'll have an update on the Paris attack shortly. We'll also get the latest business news, the sports headlines, including the final lineup for football's Europa League semi-finals. And we'll talk to children who've known nothing but war. And Shima is in the United States.
That's right, Julian. You know, we started this road trip, it feels like ages ago now, 3 months ago, close to the Capitol in West Virginia. And now we're as far away from the Capitol as one can get. We're looking at the first 100 days of the Donald Trump presidency. It's fast approaching, and we're getting the view from a state that backed him in the presidential election. We're in Idaho, in the northwest of the United States.
So first to France and, well, scenes of panic and fear on the streets of Paris.
Mesdames et messieurs, you have to stay back, please. The area is dangerous because of shotgun. Please stay back. Mesdames et messieurs, vous reculez, s'il vous plaît.
Well, that was the scene late on Thursday following a suspected terror attack right in the heart of the French capital. There'll be an emergency meeting this morning of security, defense and intelligence chiefs to discuss this latest incident, a shooting on the Champs-Élysées, an iconic avenue and tourist attraction, parts of which have now become a crime scene. One policeman was killed, two seriously wounded when a man armed with an assault rifle opened fire on a police van. These eyewitnesses described what happened.
I was walking on the pavement. There was a bus full of police. The man parked just in front of the bus, and then he got out a Kalashnikov, and then he shot six times. I thought it was fireworks. Then he went and hid behind a lorry.
We were moving towards a car, and then I heard two or three shots, but I didn't realize they were shots to start with. And well, then there was just panic all around. Everyone started running down the Champs-Élysées just by instinct. I didn't stop to work out what was going on. I just ran too.
Well, let's speak now to David Chazan, a journalist based in Paris. David, what do we know about the suspect here, the attacker?
Well, the police say that they know who he is. They verified his identity, but they're not releasing his name officially for the time being because they say investigations are still ongoing. And in particular, they want to make sure that he didn't have accomplices. However, he has been named in various media outlets. Now, this attack was claimed unusually swiftly by the so-called Islamic State group, and they named the attacker by a pseudonym, Abu Yusuf al-Bajiki, Abu Yusuf the Belgian. But the information that we're getting here is that this was a 39-year-old French national with a criminal record who was born in a northern suburb of Paris. And his home in an area called Chelles was searched during the night by the police. And this is a fairly quiet, middle-class sort of area. It seems that this man was sentenced to 20 years in prison in 2003 for the attempted murder of three men, two of whom were policemen, but that sentence was reduced to only 5 years in 2005.
So only recently we had that attack at Paris's Orly Airport attacker sort of attacking a soldier and so forth. Presumably there's going to be really increased security once again on the streets of the French capital.
Well, that's right. And there had already been fears that the election, because we've got the first round of voting in the presidential election on Sunday, and there were fears that there would be attacks during the election. On Tuesday, two suspects were arrested in Marseille. They were accused of plotting several attacks in the run-up to the election. And the French government has deployed an extra 50,000 police to guard polling stations and the final rallies by the candidates. Now, that is in addition to thousands of armed police and soldiers who are already patrolling the streets of French cities under the state of emergency that was declared after the Paris attacks in November 2015. So there really is an enormous security deployment at the moment, and people are also waiting to hear what President Hollande will say after that meeting you mentioned of defense and security chiefs to see whether there will be extra precautions around the elections, because obviously a lot of people are particularly worried about their safety.
David Chazan live there from Paris.
This is Newsday on the BBC World Service with Julian Keane in London and me, Shai Mathalil, in Boise, Idaho, also known as the Gem State, a conservative state with a big rural community, a state that voted for President Donald Trump. And it's coming up to the 100 days. This is the last leg of our road trip across America, looking at the first few months of the Donald Trump presidency. We're in downtown Boise, the capital of Idaho, and it's a real contrast, really, of its rural surroundings. This is a bustling city. We're in a cafe bar called the Creek, the Bitter Creek. People are having their dinners, watching big screens of sports. We're not very far from a really cool area called the Freak Alley, an alley with all sorts of graffiti and street art. And if you want to know what it looks like, I've tweeted a few pictures of it. Also, we're not very far from the Basque block. There's a big Basque community here. I'm joined by Troy McLean. This is a man that not only supports Donald Trump and knows Donald Trump, he's worked for Donald Trump before he became President Trump. Is that right?
That is correct, yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us, Troy.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
I mean, tell our listeners a little bit about that contrast. I mean, I say that Boise's not really a reflection of Idaho, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I definitely hear that you know, Boise is a blue city surrounded by a red state. But I think that we're all a community that, whether we're blue or red, whether we're left or right, we're flying the same darn bird. And so while I come from rural outside areas, I still come here to downtown Boise. We love the eclectic look. We love the eclectic feel. We love the culture. But this is definitely a blue community.
The excitement all around us as well.
Yeah, it makes for good conversation. It makes for, I've traveled the world now. I've spent a lot of time in Dubai. I've spent a lot of time in New York, Paris, France, Nice. I've been all over. But this is a good representation of a global community.
Very interesting. I mean, you talk about a global community, but, you know, I've been traveling to the rural community to look at what, you know, the businesses there look like, and of course the concerns for people and what they want from the president. I traveled to Wilder, Idaho, in the south, and of course I wanted to check out something that Idaho's famous for, which is potatoes. There are number plates on cars that have famous potatoes on them. That's how big potatoes are. I spent a morning on a potato farm, spoke to Doug Gross, the owner, who told me about his concerns for his business and how big potatoes are in Idaho.
If you talk to people anywhere in the world, they will always bring up potatoes and associate it with Idaho.
Because I know that you travel quite a lot around the world, and when you tell people you're from Idaho, do they know exactly what to associate it with?
Absolutely. That's the first thing that comes out of their mouth.
Tell me about you personally. How long have you been in potato farming? When did you start?
I'm a second generation farmer. I used to help my dad on the farm back in the late 50s. Started farming in 1975.
And never stopped.
And haven't quit yet, no.
I mean, given the scale of it, it does seem like this is quite a stable business. I mean, does it vary quite a lot?
The demand is very flat in the United States. This is a pretty mature industry, but our export business is booming. Trade is very important. International trade is very important to us in Idaho.
Well, let's talk more about international trade, because, of course, one of President Trump's policies and big talking points was about trade deals and reevaluating the trade deals America has with the rest of the world, which obviously will affect international trade. Do you follow that quite closely? Is that something that concerns you?
Absolutely, it does. You know, we want good, fair trade deals, but we don't want trade to stop.
What about when Donald Trump says America first, buy American, hire American?
We're in a world marketing situation now, and I don't think you can completely undo all of that. We just want to go back and evaluate the trade pacts that we have and make sure they are fair. His campaign was based on a bunch of sound bites that were, you know, definite, absolute issues without details. And I think the details will eventually filter out and it will all work out. I am optimistic about our future.
I mean, this is a vast, vast area. I mean, all across us, we can see fields. It does seem like a lot of work has been put into this part where we're walking right now, where the potato seed has been laid. Tell me about your workforce here.
Potatoes are a pretty automated crop. We use a lot of technology, but we have some concerns about the future for employees.
Why is that?
80% of our employees are Hispanic. Of those, I would say that half did come from Mexico. And we have some concerns about the Mexican border and the wall that he's threatened to put up and how that might shorten our labor force in the United States and in agriculture specifically.
My name is Rafael Luna and I work for Doug Gross Farms.
You've been here for over a decade now. Tell me what it's been like for you working here.
When I first got here, I didn't know anything about English. I mean, it's just...
Where did you move from?
From Mexico, from Guadalajara. And from Guadalajara, I've been here since 99. I came here to work. I met my wife here.
When Donald Trump got elected, and before that when he was campaigning, he spoke a lot about the Mexican community, about borders with Mexico, about immigration and border control. And I'm just wondering, watching all of this, and now with the Trump administration in place for nearly 100 days, what do you make of all of that?
He needs to meet all the people. He needs to talk about the people to do all the job. I don't think he knows the community. And I think he's only just playing the part. He's just doing politics. I don't even think he knows how to grow potatoes or where the potatoes come from.
Are you at all concerned about your life, the life that you've built for yourself, being at risk because of the Trump administration's rhetoric about immigration?
I don't worry my position because, thank God, I'm legal now. But I see other people that are struggling with what he's doing, what he's saying, and what he's about to do.
Rafael Luna there, a farm manager on Gross Farms in the south of Idaho, very concerned about the president's rhetoric about migration. We're still with Troy McClain, a man who worked with Donald Trump back there when he was a billionaire before he became president, on the TV show The Apprentice. What do you make of what you've heard?
You know, I hear about agriculture. In the state of Idaho, we're definitely an agricultural community. And so as I was sharing with your producer yesterday, I was saying, you know, there may be a lot of cause and effect, but most importantly to me and to our community in a whole is he's put a spotlight on the immigration issue. Now, whether his presentation is proper or improper, I think his intent is to put a spotlight on the issue. Do we believe that we're the land of the free and that people should come here? Overwhelmingly, I'll say yes.
So you... As a general rule, you're with it, but it's the mechanics of it.
It's the mechanics of it. I think the young lady that interviewed earlier, Emily, I think that she said it best. We just want it done in the proper way.
Troy, thank you. Stay with us.
With Newsday here on the BBC World Service with Shaima Khalil in the United States, me, Julian Keane, here in London, and also with us Alistair Ross, who has the sports headlines.
Yes, thank you. Zlatan Ibrahimovic and Marcus Rojo picked up serious-looking knee injuries as Manchester United beat Anderlecht 2-1 after extra time to book their place in the Europa League semi-final. Lyon, Celta Vigo and Ajax also won their ties and are into Friday's draw. The Indiana Pacers have thrown away a record 25-point half-time lead to lose game three of their playoff to the Cleveland Cavaliers in the best of seven Eastern Conference playoff. The Cavs now have a lead of 3-0. The Milwaukee Bucks are closing in on a 2-1 lead over the Toronto Raptors, though, in an absolute thrashing on the Bucks' home court. Tiger Woods is likely to miss the rest of the PGA Tour season after announcing he'd had a fourth surgery on his back. The recovery time from the procedure is usually around 6 months. And the former snooker world champion Neil Robertson says his career was almost derailed by an addiction to computer games. The Australian admits he could easily spend 12 hours a day playing them and says he knows many other players in a similar situation.
Thanks, Alistair. Let's talk business now. Joining us from Los Angeles is David Willis. David, the world's financial leaders gathering there in America for 3 days of talks, just as the Trump administration is considering tariff to protect one of the country's biggest industries.
Yes, indeed, Julian. The industry in question, steel making. The US has nearly 100 steel plants and elected on a promise to boost jobs in America's so-called Rust Belt states. Donald Trump is keen to protect steel workers here from the threat posed by cheap imports. And so, just a meeting of global financiers was getting underway a few streets away. The White House announced the launch of a federal investigation into steel imports from China and other countries. Chinese imports already account for more than a quarter of the US steel market. China produces more steel than it needs and sells the excess output at sometimes significantly lower prices than domestic producers. Depending on what that investigation uncovers, it could lead to tariffs on steel imports, although a report in today's Wall Street Journal raises questions about the Trump administration's move, pointing out that a buoyant dollar is pushing down the cost of imports at a time when American steel prices are already among the highest in the world, Julian.
And this comes at the start of a big meeting of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and presumably they could find themselves somewhat at odds with the Trump administration.
Yes, indeed. It's a beef about steel, just one example of the Trump administration's misgivings over the concept of an integrated global marketplace, the central goal, of course, of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, whose spring meeting got underway today in Washington, D.C. Mr. Trump had vowed to rip up or renegotiate trade agreements that he said were costing American jobs and slap harsh trade tariffs on China and Mexico. He since rowed back on quite a few of those pledges, but in a sign perhaps that America first remains the mantra of this new administration, Mr. Trump unveiled a Buy American, Hire American executive order earlier in the week, something his critics argued was at odds with the global outlook of the IMF as well. Well, we'll soon find out how the IMF will deal with this new age of American protectionism. But in her opening remarks, the organization's managing director, Christine Lagarde, acknowledged the disillusion surrounding globalization, but she also urged member nations to avoid the lure of trade barriers, as she put it.
Thanks, David. Thousands of people said to be fleeing from the Syrian town of Raqqa as US-backed Kurdish forces try to seize control of the town from so-called Islamic State. It's the latest chapter in a humanitarian crisis in Syria, with the UN saying children are paying the heaviest price. Last year, we reported on three children who've known nothing but war. What's happened to them since? We've been back to find out.
Mustafa Abdullah left Syria for safety in Jordan, but Syria's war will never leave him. A piece of shrapnel from a barrel bomb is still lodged in his brain, and it's partially paralysed his left-hand side. His hip was crushed, and one of his legs is now longer than the other. He's only six, and he's likely to be disabled for life.
We've come to meet Mustafa in his school. It's just one room in a building in Amman. Three little tables, 13 or 14 kids, all beautifully turned out, little girls with plaits in brightly coloured jumpers, and they've all got one thing in common, and that's that they've all lost their fathers, and a couple of them, like Mustafa, also lost their mothers.
My dad was carrying me when the plane came. He threw me down. He died. And so did my mum and my cousin. Me and my other cousin were hurt. They shrapnel in my head and they took it out of my arm too. And it hurts a lot.
Do you remember your mum and dad?
I remember them. When I used to go to bed, they would tuck me in. My mummy and dad went to heaven. I love Granny as my mum.
His grandmother, Fadila, now helps feed him, dress him, wash him. I just want him to walk properly again, she told me. What will become of him when I die? Three times a week, Fadila brings Mustafa for physiotherapy at a local Syrian charity.
The physio is now getting Mustafa to try to clap his hands in front of him and then clap them
over his head because his left hand hardly opens. It's very, very difficult for him to use. But slowly, slowly, they're working on it.
It's hard, frustrating work for him, but Mustafa wants to be a dentist when he grows up, and he knows he'll need both his hands.
When I move my hand like this, it really hurts. I want to eat with it to get dressed and be able to comb my hair. Nothing matters to me in the world except fixing my hand.
Despite all the challenges that Mustafa has and everything that he's been through, he just comes across as an incredibly bright little boy. Friendly, a huge cheeky smile, big brown eyes. And yet we know from his grandmother that he has horrible nightmares of him being separated from her and being back in Syria and being in danger and being afraid. But none of that shows when you see him just smiling and hugging them, and everyone who's worked with him just adores him. I'm now in Lebanon, in the hills of Mount Lebanon, and I've come to see Rua, who's now six. She was five when I last met her. And I've come to the makeshift camp where she's living now after she fled a chemical attack in Damascus, which killed hundreds and hundreds of people. And she had only a nappy over her face soaked with vinegar. It's been raining and it's muddy and miserable. And that's the sound of Rua's school.
Rua's busy learning the alphabet in a hut made of wood and tarpaulin. It's absolutely crammed with kids. Rua is near the front, a pretty and delicate girl dressed in a pink tracksuit. She wants to be a maths teacher when she grows up.
I really like to study and learn. I hope that someone comes here and builds a proper school. I hope to live in a house that has hot water so I can shower.
What do you remember about Syria?
Mummy and Daddy were in the front of the car, and I was in the back, and Daddy got shot in the leg.
Her father, Mohammed, can't work because of his injury. He can't afford the operation Rua needs to remove her tonsils, to stop her constantly getting sick. And he lies awake at night, worrying about her future.
Rua's not doing as well as she should be. If she had a bed to sleep on rather than the floor, if she had nice clothes, if she wasn't living outdoors, she would be better.
A whole generation of children like Rua have been uprooted and terrorized by Syria's war. Every year of her life, more than 1,000 children have fled the country every single day.
Caroline Hawley reporting there.
Before the news here on the BBC World Service, we ask, does the death of a loved one have to mean goodbye?
Life stories.
Under bed, there is a man sleeping.
His daughter Lisa is lovingly stroking his hair as her young children keep running in and out of the room. He's also wearing a pair of reading glasses, so dusty that I can hardly see his eyes. Now, here's the strange thing about this man, Sirinda. He died over 12 years ago. Yet, his family think that he's still very much alive and is a part of his family's day-to-day life. This is one of the distinctive customs that surround death in this part of the world. I'm Saha Zand, and I'm going to be taking you on an extraordinary journey.
Living with the Dead at bbcworldservice.com/lifestories.
Hello, welcome to Newsday with me, Julian Keane, in London. Shaima Khalil is in the United States today. We'll get more reaction to the Paris shooting and the impact it could have on the presidential election in France. We'll hear from the former South African president, who has strong and critical words to say about the governing ANC party. And we'll return to Idaho with Newsday Shaima Khalil, where her and guests have been assessing the Donald Trump presidency. It's after the latest world news.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. The French President François Hollande is to chair a meeting of his defence cabinet to discuss the security threat to Sunday's presidential election following another jihadist attack in Paris in which a police officer was killed. Two others were wounded when a gunman opened fire on a police bus on the Champs-Élysées. He was shot dead by officers as he tried to flee. French media say the suspect was a 39-year-old French national. Police have searched his home in the eastern suburbs of Paris and are investigating whether he had any accomplices. The shooting comes just days before the first round of the country's presidential election. Three candidates have cancelled campaign events in the wake of the attack. In other news, an Egyptian-American charity worker detained in Cairo for 3 years on charges of human trafficking has been flown home to the United States. Aya Hijazi was acquitted last week. Reports say President Trump had asked his Egyptian counterpart to help resolve the case. The former South African president, Kgalema Motlanthe, says he's not sure if he can support the African National Congress, led by his successor, Jacob Zuma, at the next election. Mr. Motlanthe told the BBC his vote for the ANC could not be taken as a given in 2019. Riot police in the Venezuelan capital Caracas have fired tear gas and rubber bullets at thousands of opposition demonstrators taking part in a second day of protests against the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Masked activists hurled stones and petrol bombs at police. A new research suggests that consuming artificially sweetened drinks on a daily basis may increase the risks of strokes and dementia. The study found that people who consumed at least one diet drink a day were three times as likely to suffer a stroke or dementia as people who consumed less than one such drink a week. BBC News.
Thanks for that. Hello, welcome to Newsday with Julian Keane in London. And this half hour, we're going to be going to France to get the latest from there. South Africa also, where a former president tells us he may not be voting for the governing ANC. Scheimer's in the United States.
I am. I'm in noisy Boise, as you described it a bit earlier, Julian, a blue island in a very red state of Idaho. We're in the northwest of the United States for the last leg of our road trip, and we've been speaking to loggers and farmers and students and musicians and refugees, all telling us and giving us a view about what they make of President Trump's 100 days in office.
Let's go first to France, where we had expected the news there to be dominated by the final TV appearance of the presidential contenders ahead of Sunday's election. Instead, the headline, well, they're all to do with the attack in Paris. Le Figaro's reads, attack on the Champs-Élysées, and Le Parisien, terrorism strikes in the heart of Paris. That attack claimed by so-called Islamic State, had left one policeman dead, two seriously injured. As for the gunman, he was shot dead by police. Late last night, the French president, François Hollande, gave this brief statement.
J'ai convoqué un conseil de défense demain matin à 8 heures.
I have convened a crisis meeting for 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Our security forces, our police, our military police will remain on the highest state of alert, as has been the case for a few months. And we will remain very vigilant, especially in light of the upcoming election.
Well, while all that was happening, the 11 candidates vying for the presidency were making their final pitch to voters on TV. The attack prompted this live reaction during his interview from the centrist frontrunner Emmanuel Macron.
Nous aspirons tous et toutes à devenir.
We all aspire to become president of the Republic. And the first duty of the president is to protect. Tonight, while we've been talking, we know that at least one police officer has been killed. This threat is incalculable, and it's going to be part of our daily lives for years to come.
Let's find out more about the impact the attack had on those pre-election televised interviews. I spoke to Hélène Beckmézian, deputy editor-in-chief of the online edition of the French daily Le Monde.
It was very strange because we didn't know exactly what happened and we didn't know how many people were killed. We knew one policeman were killed, but then there was a rumor about a second one. So on the television, the journalist said things that were false. So the candidate were commenting something without knowing exactly what was happening.
Is this the kind of issue which would favour one candidate rather than another? I don't know if any one of them were taking perhaps a sort of stronger line regarding these sort of terror attacks.
Well, there's Marine Le Pen from the far-right party who always said we don't do enough to protect the French people. So maybe it's in favour for her, this kind of event. And maybe for François Fillon also from the right party. So, yeah, maybe for these two candidates, this could be kind of a good thing.
And just looking ahead to the actual sort of when we get to election day, there might be a fear also with with fear on the streets of France and other cities, whether it could, you know, affect the turnout on election day.
It's really, really, really hard to say, because even without this shooting, without these attacks, we've never seen an election like this before. We have four candidates. We don't know which one are going to be on the second term. And it's impossible to know what's going to happen on Sunday. Everything can happen.
Can I ask you about the actual television, let's call them interviews, because it wasn't really a debate. Did we learn anything that we didn't know before about any of the candidates?
No, not really, because now the campaign, it's the end of the campaign. So we know all of the 11 candidates. We know the big lines of their programs. There was nothing new tonight. Actually, we are all wondering what was really the object, the
point
utility.
The point of it,
exactly.
Because French people have had enough. I mean, there's been, and when you've got 11 candidates, I mean, it's just, even the last debate, it lasted 4 hours, and this one they had, 15 minutes each. It's just an eternity.
Yes, it's an eternity. It's very long. Everybody is fed up with this campaign. Everybody wants to be on Sunday, wants to know who is going to run for the second term. So this debate, I don't know if there were many people on television. I don't think so, because people are really, they're fed up with everything. They have seen too much political show, too much people on TV, and now we want it to end.
It's Hélène Bekmezian of the French daily Le Monde.
This is Newsday on the BBC World Service with Julian Keane in London. Shaima Khalil here in the Gem State, also known as Idaho. Moving on from French politics to American politics. And Julian's guest there saying that people are a bit fed up with politics. Well, people here that don't seem to get enough of it. They can't stop watching. President Trump has been providing them with a lot to think about and a lot to watch. The tweets, the controversy, the executive orders, and him, of course, conflicting with the media, to put it mildly. It's coming up to 100 days of the Donald Trump presidency, and Americans are taking stock of what President Trump was able to achieve in those first months in power. We're in downtown Boise, the capital of Idaho, and really a contrast in the environment here to the majorly rural areas around it in Idaho. There is a big Basque community here. Donald Trump's presidency has proved as controversial and divisive as his campaign. And here to talk to us about it is Jacqueline Kettler, political scientist of Boise State University. Jacqueline, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for staying up late for us as well.
Of course.
So tell me about the conversation here in Idaho. This is a state that backed the president, that helped him get into the White House. What are they making of the first 100 days? Well, we're approaching the first 100 days.
Well, I think it would be very mixed, probably like many states, right? We've got some areas that are going to be much more supportive of what's been happening, and other populations that are concerned, continue to be concerned about what the policies are seeing discussed, the rhetoric that's coming out of the White House. The lack of movement and to fill some open position. So I think you can kind of see the polarization across the country within the state some.
It's interesting, though, because that's the same kind of polarization we've been talking about when he was candidate, when he won the presidency, and in the very early days of his presidency. That hasn't changed.
No, I don't think so. And I think part of it's we're so polarized as partisans that I think no matter who the president is, this is going to be the case to some degree now.
I want to talk to you about political interests and political involvement. I got together with a group of students to see what they think of the Trump presidency, and also talk to them about, you know, political engagement. We spoke here in the city of Boise, and I asked them how closely they follow politics in Washington, D.C.
We're in downtown, and you wouldn't know that we're in downtown because we're surrounded by green and trees, and just beyond that is the Boise State University campus. And this is where I'm meeting
my next group of guests. And if I could just ask you to introduce yourselves to everyone.
My name is Holly, and I'm also a fourth-year mechanical engineering student.
My name is Benjamin Chaffetz. I am the chair of Boise State University College Republicans and a third-year electrical engineering student.
Hi, my name is Jimena Bustillo, and I am a first-year Boise State student, double major political science and media arts.
Hi, my name is Jackson Bidner. I'm a first-year student at Boise State, and I'm studying kinesiology.
There is a huge media frenzy that I'm sure many of you have picked up on the first 100 days of President Trump's administration. A lot of buzz in the media, a lot of buzz, of course, in Washington and around it. And I'm just wondering if any of that trickles down to Idaho, trickles down to you guys in your day-to-day lives.
This election, I feel like everybody can agree, was very emotional for both sides, for a lot of different reasons. And that kind of emotional backing, you know, tends to result in those knee-jerk reactions because you're not necessarily always going to think about clarifying, and that works on both sides.
That's an interesting point you brought up a minute. Like, I think a lot of people are really focusing on the emotional aspect of politics when that is absolutely the worst thing that you should be doing. And politics, government, it's not supposed to be emotional. The president was never meant to be a social justice warrior. The federal government was never meant to be this involved. I mean, when you make an emotional argument as opposed to a logical one, you're not speaking in terms that everyone can define or live by.
Jimena, you said, see, you guys have made a deliberate decision, a very conscious decision to be involved, to be informed. But whether that is reflective of the rest of the student body, I mean, do people care that it's 100 days of President Trump's administration? Do people care about the Russian connection, you know, the bombing of Syria? Do these things come up, or do people just think, you know what, that doesn't really concern us?
On campus, I feel like a lot of students don't want to be out with it with their political like stances, because I feel like at least this last political cycle was so polarized because of these two candidates. One side hated the other candidate so much, and the other side hated the other candidate so much. It kind of turned the two parties against each other.
Do you think that Donald Trump's presidency, that Donald Trump elected to office, has made people or young people more involved in politics or less involved in politics?
Personally, from what I'm seeing, is a lot of friends are angry, and it's a good thing, because they should be angry, because we got here in the first place. We had a vote for, you know, the lesser of two evils, really, and it's a good thing to see people angry, because then action can be taken upon it.
It's kind of like, it pushed people to two extremes, like, either they just don't want to do anything with politics, or they're like, super involved, and they want to get their hands on everything, so I definitely think it kind of pushed people to two extremes.
I would piggy off of that as well, definitely agree with Jackson, and say that the two people that got pushed to definitely get super hyper-politics, also then polarized within that hyper-politics section, kind of like he mentioned earlier, and then just increase political activity, but to the extremes on both sides.
My girlfriend doesn't want me to talk politics unless unless it's at 1 hour designated time every day. She's like, okay, you can start now, and she's got the stopwatch right there.
Yeah. I mean, Boise State College Republicans has seen an uptrend in, you know, members, but, I mean, they're not very excited either. I mean, again, they're more conservative than Republican, like me. It's hard to say. Some of my friends are like, get away from me, and it's really out of the fact that they're upset, you know, rather than that they're not into politics. So it's hard for me to answer that question. Again, we could do research.
I don't have a stopwatch, but I'm going to round it off there. Guys, thank you so much for speaking to me and bringing me here. It's a fantastic place. And, you know, for better or worse, you guys seem very passionate about, you know, your sides of the argument. And it's been quite enlightening speaking to you. Thank you.
That was Ben, Holly, Jimena, and Jackson speaking about their politics there and their political views. And I'm picking something that Jimena said about hyper-politics, Jacqueline, and the fact that people are just so wired and so in tune. Is that really reflective of what you see in Idaho?
I think so. I think increasingly we're seeing many people, like, they're so political, it's bleeding into other parts of lives. And, like, people can't, some people are having problems interacting normally with people due to political disagreements. But I do think that Idaho in general tends to be a pretty friendly place.
Yeah.
So I do find that even though many of us are, you know, very political right now, we still manage to get along.
Yeah. But interesting, though, one of them mentioned that people are quite angry. But, for example, you know, you drive a couple of hours away from Boise. You know, we drove to Council, a rural area, you know, where the forests are. And, you know, people there are very happy that Donald Trump is still in power. You know, we're into his 100 days. Are Donald Trump supporters changing their mind at all, or are they still very adamant?
I think right now, I think a chunk are very happy. They're seeing exactly what they wanted to see in a Trump administration. I think some are maybe a little concerned, but want to wait and see. It's still pretty early in this presidency, and you know, I don't know that they were completely prepared to take the presidency. And so I think some people are, let's wait and see.
You know, being here in Boise, but being in Idaho in general, I mean, Washington feels very, very far away. Does all the kind of toing and froing and you know, the scuffles within the Donald Trump White House and the presidency and the policies, does that trickle down to everyday life? Are people that engaged?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know for sure. I think there is often a frustration with D.C. in general here among Democrats and Republicans. And so I think that sometimes there's just a general frustration in why can't things happen in some efficient way there.
It's really interesting you should say that, because again, when we went out to the rural areas, people made their feelings about Washington very clear. Washington, D.C., they don't like it at all. The man in Washington, D.C., Donald Trump, they like him a lot.
Sure, yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, that's being a partisan position, right? Like, somewhat, it's like, okay, that's a person of our party. We can support them a little bit more now.
And in your assessment, as a political scientist, what do you make of those 100 days?
What do you
tell your students?
It's been very interesting. Every day is something that I never thought I'd be discussing in class.
Like, what are the discussions you're having in class?
Well, it's just like, you know, with having the vice president vote on a nominee for education secretary, that was completely new, or having all these unfilled positions to some degree, or just, you know, it's always exciting every day in class.
Never a dull moment, you can say.
Not
that.
So far.
Do you have a lot of discussions about Twitter?
There's a lot of jokes always about Twitter. The students definitely are aware that the president's tweeting and seem to, you know, make a light of it.
Jacqueline, thank you. Jacqueline Kettler, they're political scientists from Boise State University. More from us in Idaho in the northwest of the United States when we come back.
Thanks for that. This is Newsday on the BBC World Service. Let's go to South Africa now. We've heard a lot on the programme about the growing pressure on the government of President Jacob Zuma. Now another voice has been added to the criticism, that of former President Halema Motlanthe, who was Mr Zuma's immediate predecessor. Now he's told us his vote for the African National Congress can't be taken as a given in the 2019 election, and he predicts the party could lose its parliamentary majority. He's been talking to our correspondent Karen Allen and started with comments made by the new finance minister at a conference in Washington.
If a minister can say, well, you know, the rand can fall, we'll just pick it up, that shows really a cavalier attitude towards a very, very serious matter. It's populism of the worst kind, where it's, you know, people who want to just say the, you know, issue statements that may resonate with poor people who have no understanding of the bigger issue. So it's really disheartening.
What was the moment for you when you said enough is enough? I have to speak out.
Well, it goes back, you know, more than a year ago, when the Constitutional Court, which is the apex court of the land, said the president had failed to protect and defend and uphold the Constitution, which is his obligation in terms of oath of office. I thought at that point the honorable thing for the president would have been to step aside.
Did you tell him that at the time?
Well, you know, I made my views very clear, even at that time, because it doesn't make sense when, you know, even in parliament, ordinary members of parliament, honourable members of parliament, now say he's not an honourable person to head the state.
Is it going to cost them votes come 2019, do you think, if Mr Zuma remains president until the end of this year?
Definitely. I think you know, it, as I said, it's a great cost to the ANC in terms of its prestige and standing in the eyes of ordinary South Africans.
Let me be more specific. If Mr. Zuma remains until the end of this year as the leader of party and not a great deal changes, could we actually see the elections come 2019, see the ANC actually lose to the opposition, or at least lose key ground in urban areas?
I think we'll see the ANC lose its majority. It will definitely muster less than 50% plus one. And it's primarily because, you know, you're dealing here with incorrigibility. You see, if you were dealing with one indiscretion and having to manage that and recover from it, it would be manageable. Problem is that it doesn't stop. You know, every month you are confronted by a new problem. And the problems revolve around the same individual.
Former South African President Kgalema Motlanthe. Reminder of our main news headline. France's President François Hollande is to chair a meeting of his defense cabinet to discuss the security threat to Sunday's presidential election following another deadly jihadist attack in Paris. Time for the sports news. Here's Alistair Ross.
Thank you. Manchester United are through to the semi-final of the Europa League. They beat Anderlecht 2-1 after extra time at Old Trafford. That takes them to through 3-2 on aggregate. But the win came at the cost of potentially serious knee injuries to Marcus Rojo and to Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Even though United have been reliant on the Swedes' goals, Rojo's injury is arguably the more worrying. United do have other strikers, but with Chris Smalling and Phil Jones also injured, they are now running out of defenders. And Mourinho is calling on the two English players to hurry their return.
And I think it's time for Jones and Smalling to be brave, to risk, because for the team, you have to do everything. That's the way I think. You cannot do miracles, so miracles I don't expect, but you have to try to do everything to accelerate the process.
Well, United's was one of the three quarterfinals to need extra time. Ajax fought back with 10 men to beat the German club Schalke 4-3 on aggregate. Lyon knocked out Besiktas on penalties. Celta Vigo's 1-1 draw with Genk was enough to see the Spanish club through over the two legs. They all go into the Europa League draw then. That is made on Friday, straight after the Champions League draw, where Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid, Monaco and Juventus will find out who they will face in the last four. The Cleveland Cavaliers have completed a record postseason comeback to overhaul a 25-point halftime deficit to the Indiana Pacers. A 119-114 win leaves them one game away from the conference semi-finals. LeBron James also picked up an NBA milestone in that match. He passed Kobe Bryant to become the third highest scoring player in NBA postseason history. Only Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Michael Jordan have more. The Memphis Grizzlies are also 3-0 up in their series against the San Antonio Spurs after a 105-94 victory. The Milwaukee Bucks thrashed the Toronto Raptors 104-77 to go 2-1 up in theirs. Ethiopia's Feyesa Lelisa says he will make an anti-government sign again if he achieves success at the London Marathon this weekend. The Olympic silver medalist is living in exile in the USA, saying he's scared he'll be killed if he returns home because of the gesture he made on the podium in Rio.
Automatically they kill me. If they not kill me, they put in jail. If not put in jail, they close in airport. I cannot see any other country ever again. How can I regret? I come from the people. My people is dying still. I never regret. I will make again strong.
Now, the Ethiopian government, of course, maintains that he would be welcomed as a hero if he were to return. And Tiger Woods has had another operation on his back. It's his fourth and is likely to rule him out for the rest of the PGA Tour season. The 14-time major winner says he needed more relief from back and neck pain.
Thanks, Alistair. And how do you deal with teenage hackers? So one story making the headlines here in the UK concerns a young hacker who pleaded guilty to charges of developing and selling software that was used for more than 1.5 million attacks on websites worldwide. He's due to appear in court today. One person who knows a thing or two about this issue is Vince Warrington. He's been looking at ways to encourage young, talented computer experts to turn away from cybercrime and think instead of a career in his area of expertise, cybersecurity. He's been telling me more about it.
At the moment, we've got a situation where there's a real lack of a career path for cybersecurity. One of the things that people are starting to look at is how do we define that career path? Some of that will be talking with teachers and with parents, and part of it is to work with the industry.
But there's an image problem also, isn't there? Because when we hear the words teenage hacker, straight away you get this image of some sort of computer geek alone in a bedroom, hunched over his laptop and up to no good.
Yes, exactly. I mean, one of the issues I have with the industry in general is that we've relied on this old image of the hooded figure and a glowing computer screen. But really what's happening is when people hear about kids working with computers and potentially doing things like hacking, they're instantly assuming that they're up to no good, they're up to some bad things, they're going to get into trouble with the law, which has happened to some people. But it's almost like we're predisposing people to say that anyone who's taking an interest in computers and how they work and how they can manipulate them from a young age is up to no good. So one of the things that's a real challenge for the cybersecurity industry is for itself to move away from this kind of almost tired old image into something a lot more professional. Just because you're involved in working out how computers operate and how you can manipulate them doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It means that you've got a great talent for actually doing quite a lot of good in the world. So one of the things we need to do is actually get in quite early with people and say that there are some good things you can do with this, but there are also some bad things you can do with this. There's a level of ethics involved in this industry, and you can use exactly the same skills for good that you use for doing the bad thing.
Vince Warrington there. Before we go, let's have a quick word with Shimer in the United States. Shimer, you're on your third trip in a very short space of time in the US, sort of taking stock of the Trump presidency. I just wonder whether over the course of those travels, different places, of course, different views, but are the views of people changing towards Mr. Trump or not?
Do you know, it's really interesting. You know, we've been on the road back and forth, you know, between London and the United States for 3 months now, from the day of the inauguration till the countdown to the first 100 days. And what really interests me is that the kind of arguments that I've heard, the kind of division, but also the kind of tension and ratcheting up of the rhetoric is still the same. The people who've supported Donald Trump when he got elected are still as charged and happy and optimistic as they were when they voted for him. And the people who did not vote for him are still as upset and pessimistic as they were a few months ago. You know, you don't see people kind of like coming around. And that's the other thing that you notice, is that there really has been a whole part of America that hasn't been speaking to the other part as well, and that's really what we've been trying to do: hear those voices and try and understand.
Lovely, Shimer. By the way, if you're thinking of something to do, I've been checking lots of things to do in Boise tomorrow. The Record Exchange in downtown Boise is holding a record store day. Apparently, it's a must-see event for music geeks. I don't know if you qualify.
There you go. So you'll know where I am. When the bosses call for me to work, I'll be like, oh, Julian said I could go to the record store. Sorry.
Getting some vinyl. Shimer, thanks for that. That's it from Shimer and for me. It's Newsday on the BBC World Service.
This is the BBC World Service. Here's Rebecca Kesby with more about the next BBC Africa debate.
Gambia has its first new government in more than 20 years. Gambians have high expectations that...